Life has taken more time in reviewing certain sections than I had expected to. I think it's wise to get well in mind the material we are covering. It means that there are four verses, though, which are right, quite unrelated in most ways to the rest of the prophecies, which I had thought I'd be able to spend 2 or 3 hours on. And as it is, we won't spend a great deal of time on them. Now, on those, there are 2 or 3 or 4 questions in this list of 27. But those questions will certainly be covered, but probably next week rather than today. If you can have a chance to look them over a bit between now and the next class, it may be that it will suggest to your mind certain things that aren't clear, that you would think it wise to have me say a word about it the next class. In such a case, I wish you would write out any such questions and get them to me, if possible, ahead of class, but at least as soon as class starts. Now, we have looked at the history of Antiochus Epiphanes, and we have seen how precisely there are statements about him in chapter 11. The idea that chapter 11, all of a sudden at chapter 21, has an unmentioned interval jumping forward to Antichrist would be rather ridiculous, because the preceding verses tell about his ancestors and his brother in so much detail, and there's not much point to it except leading up to this terrible crisis that was faced by Judaism. And this terrible crisis is described by the long account of the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, which was section D there. And then in section E, we look at the, we already spoke about Daniel 11:36-12:3, under which we notice, number one, the king's character and career, and we notice a number of points in which, I mentioned a number of points in which it was quite obvious that most of the material from 11:36-12:3 could not possibly be considered as a continued account of Antiochus. Those who hold the Maccabean view either say these are the guesses of the writer as to what might happen in the future, or else they say that these are things that actually happened but we have no historical record of. So that the particular events described in them just don't fit with anything we know about Antiochus Epiphanes. And the account of the character of this man is utterly different from Antiochus, who has built great temples to the gods of his fathers. This is one who will disregard the gods of his fathers and turn away from them. And we notice this is one who will honor the god of fortresses, a good expression for a purely materialistic viewpoint, which would have been rather ununderstandable to people in ancient times, but which today fits exactly with the attitude of the leaders of a very large part of the world. In that section, we have number two, the time of trouble and deliverance. We looked briefly at that. This very terrible time that is described, which could be taken as describing the time of the crisis under the Maccabees. But since we have a description of a very different situation, it's more reasonable to take it as something that is to happen in connection with a different one than Antiochus, a much later one. And then we notice that number three, as number three there, we notice that the chapter 12, verse 2, describes a resurrection. And so if this section goes clear to the resurrection, it is obvious there must be a very long unmentioned interval, at least 2,000 years, somewhere between the account of Antiochus Epiphanes and the end. It'd be rather absurd to put it just before the mention of the resurrection. It is much more logical to put it the place we did, between verses 35 and 36, though some have suggested other points at which to place it. Now that was E, and I want to go on now to glance at F, which is Daniel 12:4-13. As we have noticed, the chapters 10 to 12 are one unit. And it is very unfortunate that the Archbishop made the division of chapter 11 where he did. If he'd made it one verse later, it could make a reasonable division. Though actually it's one continuous passage, chapters 10 through 12. And so, 12, 4 to 13, I want to say a few words about verse 4. I'll read from the New International Version now. Verse 4 says, "But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge." Now that is the translation that the NIV has. In the King James Version, it was a little more ambiguous. They rendered it, "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." There's not a great difference between the two in the wording, but there's a tremendous difference in meaning. As it stands in the King James Version, "Shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." Isaac Newton wrote a discussion, one of the greatest scientists who ever lived, wrote a discussion of Daniel. And in his discussion, he said that this statement described how things would come to pass in the latter days, that many would go to and fro. He said there will be traveling such as the world has never seen before. In fact, he said, "I wouldn't be surprised if people would travel as fast as 60 miles an hour in those days." And Voltaire, the great French atheist, said that Newton's commentary on Daniel was a good example of how when a great mind, scientific mind, turns to the study of the Bible, he gets into nonsense. He says, "How could anybody travel 60 miles an hour? They wouldn't be able to take their breath. They would die immediately." And, of course, we know now how completely wrong Voltaire was. We know that to us today, what Newton thought was a tremendous speed today is quite commonplace. But actually, that's not what the passage means at all. It doesn't mean that there will be a great increase in travel. It is definitely related to the first part of the verse. He is to seal up the books until the days approach when the statements in the book are immediately relevant to people's situation. And then many will hunt back and forth, and knowledge shall be increased. The NIV says to increase knowledge. Both are a possible interpretation of the Hebrew. I think the King James says that as they hunt back and forth, they're going to find more understanding of what the passage means. The NIV simply says, in order to try to get more understanding of what it means. I think perhaps in this regard, the King James is a little better there, but either of them is much clearer. But I mean, the NIV in the first part is much clearer than the King James traveled to and fro. The same word is used, Hebrew word, where it speaks that the eyes of the Lord go to and fro throughout the earth in order to observe the good and the wicked. It is not a traveling, but a hunting, a searching, seeking out. Well, these rest of the book tells, we won't take time to look into details of the rest of the book since we have a number of important things to look at. And there is some of this that is not very clear exactly what it means, but Daniel is told that the greater part of the purpose of his prediction is for time in the future, quite a distance off. Now, of course, those who hold the Maccabean view hold that it was actually written at the time of the Maccabees, but pretended to be by Daniel, telling things for that period. And that would fit to be a long distance off, to have it written about 530 B.C. and have it look forward to events about 160. It's a period of about four centuries, you see, which is a very, very long distance. If somebody had predicted events now in the times of the Pilgrim Fathers, that would have been very difficult to do. It would be looking way ahead. And so there is much in the book that looks way ahead to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. But of course, as we found in chapter 11, there is also a great deal that looks way beyond the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And of course, the interesting thing is that we start our prophecies with chapter 2, where we see the complete destruction of the statue representing human government through the years. And that complete destruction has not yet come. So that his prophecy begins with the look way on, the thousands of years to the future. But then in later chapters, he looks at the great crisis that comes at an earlier time. And now we have, I've given you a couple of assignments on chapter 8, but we have not looked into chapter 8. And chapter 8 is a parallel to these other chapters, which I thought it was good to leave and to have our discussion of Antiochus Epiphanes under 11 instead of under 8. Although in some ways chapter 8 is clearer about Antiochus Epiphanes than chapter 11 is. They give, each of them tells us a good deal about him, and there's no contradiction between the statements, but various aspects are emphasized in them. And so I want to turn now to chapter 8, and under that, A is the setting. Now, I think I may have made a mistake under that in copying the dates of all these chapters, because if you try to copy all that, it may divert your attention from the amount of material we want to get over. But I wanted to bring out the fact that the chapter 2 is given in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, about 602 B.C., and then the next prophetic vision we have is at least 45 years later. I say first year of Belshazzar, 556 or later. And you know the reason I say or later is because we have no record of the time when Belshazzar became king. His father Nabonidus became king in 556, if I recall correctly. It's on your sheet that I gave you of the historical, of the dates of the kings. But Nabonidus, at some time in his reign, made his son Belshazzar co-king with him. I would think it unlikely that he did it immediately. But he certainly did it at least a few years before the conquest by Cyrus in 539. And so the first year of Belshazzar is either 556 or later. 45 years at least after chapter 2, we have Daniel's vision, which not merely shows the four kingdoms shown in chapter 2, and not merely tells about the complete destruction of human government as predicted, but in addition to that shows something of the latter days before that destruction. Tells about the little horn that fights against the saints and prevails against them until the Ancient of Days comes and gives the victory to the saints and destroys the entirely and completely the beast which was represented by the little horn. And then in the third year of Belshazzar, 2 years later, we have this eighth chapter. Ninth chapter. It says at the beginning, in the first year of Darius the Mede, who was made king over the realm of Babylon, and the statement was made king should make it rather obvious that Darius the Mede was not the great emperor, but was Cyrus's representative. Professor Wiseman thinks that this was another name for Cyrus. It seems more likely that it is one spoken of in his inscriptions as Gobryas. At any rate, he was a man who was made king over the Babylonian province under the great emperor Cyrus. He evidently did not hold that position many years. In fact, it says he was quite elderly when he received the kingdom, because chapter 10 begins in the third year of Cyrus the Persian, which would be about 537. And so chapter 8 is the third year of Belshazzar. And number two, I said Shushan. It says in the King James Version that in his vision he was at Shushan the palace. The NIV says, in my vision I saw myself in the citadel of Susa. Now, Shushan is what the Hebrew said. Susa is what the way the NIV takes it. The fact is that both are true, because the ancient Babylonians wrote the word as Shushan, but we have pretty good evidence that they didn't pronounce it as Shuh, they pronounced it Suh. So the one is what's actually written in the Hebrew, Shushan. Susa is probably the way they actually pronounce it. And Susa was a great capital of a regime that had fought the Assyrians for many years, though finally conquered by them. It was probably part of the area held by Cyrus at this time when Daniel had this vision. And so the fact that Daniel saw himself in this place, to which he had probably gone in the past as a diplomatic representative, but now he sees himself over there, is a suggestion of great changes to come. Now, number three, the order of presentation. This we need not linger over because it was an assignment I gave you some time ago, to look at chapter 8 and note how much was vision and how much was interpretation. Verses 2 to 12 is the vision, and then while he's still in the vision, he hears a saint ask another a question and the other saint answer. Now that, you might say, is still part of the vision, but I've simply listed it separately here, verses 13 to 14. And then we have four verses, I guess it's five verses given, to where God sends the angel Gabriel to explain the vision to Daniel. And he says he will explain it to him, and so verses 20 to 26 are interpretation. And then the final verse is Daniel's reaction. He was tremendously upset, as we read in the last verse, by this vision which he had then. Now, we will call B a part of the vision proper, the two beasts. We have here then two animals described, and they are very different from the animals in chapter 2. We have in verses 3 to 8, we have them described. In verses 20 to 22, we have the interpretation of them. And instead of the ferocious-looking beasts described in chapter 7, we have a he-goat, and we have a ram. And the first one goes butting his way, pushing and covering the ground, going across the earth toward the west and the north and the south. It is a good description of Cyrus's conquest. And we have then the goat is described as coming from the west and going so fast that he hardly touches the ground. It exactly fits. And so we have the description of Alexander the Great's very rapid conquest. Cyrus's was tremendous, but Alexander the Great was much faster. These verses describe it rather vividly. We won't take time to go into them in detail. But we notice that in the interpretation in verses 20 to 22, that the NIV reads, "The two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat is the king of Greece, and the large horn between his eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation, but will not have the same power." That would seem to make it very definite that this is a picture of the same events which are described in chapter 7 and described again in chapter 11. But then we have a new thing in chapter 8, and here we find that we are confused by the fact that in the King James Version, it speaks of a little horn. The NIV says, "Out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power." And that is quite different from the King James, a little horn. Actually, in chapter 7, where we had the little horn that represents the Antichrist, the little horn there was in the Aramaic literally that. The words were a horn, a little one. But here, the wording in the Hebrew is a horn from littleness. And a horn from littleness, the NIV has very well described by saying another horn which started small but grew. Oh, a horn from littleness. Or it could point to an opposition away from littleness. This Hebrew preposition is used in those two senses. It is, shows origin from, or it shows opposition, more than. And so if you took it a horn more than littleness, you could mean a strong horn. And the ancient Greek translation here renders it a strong horn. I think probably the NIV interpretation is more accurate, one that began little and became great. But it is not the same terminology as in chapter 7. Now, the holders of the Maccabean interpretation, of course, would say the little horn in chapter 7 is Antiochus Epiphanes, and so is the little horn in chapter 8. They're both Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, in chapter 7, the little horn comes out of the fourth kingdom. In chapter 8, it comes out of the Greek kingdom, which is the third kingdom. This horn from littleness. And it describes Antiochus Epiphanes, who did not have a right to the throne, who came in with a small force and managed to get control. So we have the tendency of the critics to try to equate the two is one we must avoid, but that doesn't mean we should go to the opposite extreme and say wherever it speaks of a great enemy of God, it describes Antichrist, because we have two great crises in the book of Daniel. We look forward to the coming of Antiochus Epiphanes a long ways off, nearly four centuries after the time when Daniel wrote, and we look forward to the coming of Antichrist at least 2,000 years after that. And so we have two different crises shown. Well, now, in this one comes out of the third kingdom, not the fourth, as in chapter 7. So in chapter 7, we look forward to a great crisis that has not yet occurred. Here we are looking to this great crisis that did occur in the time of the Maccabees. And so the account tells us about him, how he came out of one of the parts of Alexander's empire. It describes his arrogance. And it says that he caused sacrifice to cease. Verse 12 says, the daily sacrifice was taken away. He did away with the daily sacrifice. And we find how exactly that was fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes, who so polluted the temple that no pious Jew could enter it. And the regular morning and evening sacrifices were no longer made. And instead of that put up a statue to Jupiter and polluted the temple. And the Maccabean revolt eventually resulted in their getting control of the temple again and taking out the altar that had been polluted from it. So this description of Antiochus Epiphanes then, all these things are precisely fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes. And yet it is strange, we mustn't go to the other extreme from the critics and say that every time it speaks of a great enemy of God in these passages, speaking about Antichrist. But there are many who find it difficult to think that chapter 8 is simply telling about the great crisis under Antiochus Epiphanes, that is what is there described. They think that Antichrist must in some way be in chapter 8. He's very clearly in chapter 7. He's very clearly in chapter 11. In fact, they both are very clearly in chapter 11, as we've seen. But there are many who insist he must be also in this chapter. And some have even gone so far as to say the vision here is about Antiochus Epiphanes, but the interpretation's all about Antichrist. Well, since the interpretation starts with saying that it represents the kings of Media and Persia and the king of Greece, as it is described, it seems rather ridiculous to take that view. And so a larger number will say that this is describing Antiochus Epiphanes, but that he is a type of Antichrist. It seems to me that we introduce unnecessary confusion into the scripture when we make some future thing a type of some other future thing if there's no scriptural statement that says that that is the case. It seems to me quite clear that here in chapter 8, we are talking exclusively about Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the reason why many feel that this must be about Antichrist is verses 17 and 19. I'll read them from the NIV. As he came near the place where, starting with 16, I heard a man's voice from the Uli saying, Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision. As he came near the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. Son of man, he said to me, understand that the vision concerns the time of the end. Well, that phrase, the time of the end, can suggest it means the time of the end of the age. But the expression end is used in the scripture in many different ways. The end of your faith. You are receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls, the New Testament says. It can speak of the end of somebody's reign, the end of some situation. It means it concerns something that is not in Daniel's time, but is quite a distance forward, the time of the end. There are many cases where it very obviously does not refer to the very end of the age. And so, he continues in verse 19, he said, I'm going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. And one commentary says that nothing ended at the time of the Maccabees, and so it must look forward to Antichrist. But of course that is an erroneous statement. Nothing ended at the time of Antichrist. Antiochus, the persecution that Antiochus began, that great persecution, came to an end when the Maccabees gained their freedom and set up Judea as a separate state. Or if you want something bigger than that to come to an end, the captivity began, as you know, in the time of taking of Jerusalem. The captivity began then, and the exile began then. The exile ended in 538 B.C. because Cyrus gave a decree that the people who desired could go back and could rebuild the city. And so the exile ended there, but not the captivity, because they were still under control of the Persians. And they continued under their control until Alexander the Great destroyed the Persian Empire, and then Palestine was under the control of the Ptolemies after Alexander died, and under the Ptolemies for 100 years, and then under the Seleucids. And so the captivity continued till the time of the Maccabees, but the captivity ended with the Maccabees. And they had about 100 years of being independent before the Romans took them over. So it certainly is a time of an end of a very vital development in the history of Israel. Well, there's more detail that would be interesting in this chapter. If we had considerable time, I would like to take the statements about Antiochus in the first part in the vision and parallel them with the statements in the interpretation, and it's very interesting to see how each of them gives us some information that is not given in the other. But I don't think we will take time for that now, since the semester is drawing so near to the close. I would like to put on the board for a minute now a brief outline of these four different chapters. It doesn't cover anything but what we've already looked at, but it perhaps makes it a little more vivid. In Daniel 2, the four the four parts of the statute, the five parts of which the last two are joined together. In chapter 7, the four animals, and then followed by the little horn. And chapter 2, leading up to the complete destruction of the statue. Chapter 7, the beast of which the little horn is part, being completely destroyed and his body given to the fire. And then the new kingdom in chapter 2, the Son of Man's kingdom in chapter 7. One of the suggested questions I've put there is what is said about saints in the book of Daniel. And we find that if we looked at one place this morning where in chapter 8 here, where he heard a saint ask another. Now that word saint, a holy one or a saint, we don't know exactly what it refers to there. But the word saint is used several times in chapter 7, where the Antichrist fights against the saints and seems about to destroy them, but the Ancient of Days comes and the kingdom is given to the saints. The Son of Man has been given a kingdom that he shall reign, a kingdom that cannot be destroyed, but the kingdom is given to the saints. So there is at least a part of the time when the Son of Man reigns, complete reigns, in power over this earth, when the saints, as his representatives, are in power. You find many people talking about the eternal age. Some say there can be no millennium when Christ comes back. There must be an eternal age because the kingdom, we are told, cannot be destroyed, the kingdom of Christ. Well, it is quite plain that the kingdom of Christ cannot be destroyed, but there's no reason it cannot change its form in such ways as he may choose. And so the kingdom of the saints would seem to last for 1,000 years, and what is after that, we do not know. I do not find the words eternal state anywhere in Scripture. I think they are a philosophical conception that has no solid basis. I see no evidence that time comes to an end. Time is simply the possibility of things following one another. And there's no reason to think that things can't follow one another after the great white throne judgment. But God has not revealed to us what will happen then. But we notice chapter 8, I put the ram a little lower down in the picture here, because it doesn't tell us in chapter 8 which of the animals or parts of the statue it corresponds to. But the description makes it very clear that it is the second and that the he-goat is the third animal. And then the horn from littleness there. And there we have a great crisis. Then in Daniel 11 we have these same two kingdoms described, Persia and Greece. And then we have the crisis in verse 21 to 35. And then we jump to the still greater crisis in verse 36 and following. Now, there's much more we could say about chapter 8, but I want to have a few minutes, at least, on those four verses which are found in chapter 9. So I'm going to make six chapters. Daniel 9, 24 to 27. Now in Daniel 9, we have a great prayer which Daniel gives. Daniel sees that there had been a prophecy made by Jeremiah that Jerusalem would be desolate for 70 years. Now when did the desolation begin? Does the desolation begin with the destruction of the city? Or does the desolation begin with the great destruction in the territory near, and the great number of people who were taken into captivity at the time when Daniel was taken into captivity? It is pretty hard to be sure on that, when those 70 years would begin. But in chapter 9, we find that Daniel, after the Babylonian Empire has been destroyed, and Darius the Mede has taken over as Cyrus's representative. Daniel prays. He figures it's about 70 years that he has been away from Jerusalem, and that the territory around Jerusalem has been desolate. Now he prays, "Oh God, you've said there'd be 70 years of desolation. Now is a time we can go back to our homeland. We can reestablish the glory of Jerusalem. We can have things established as they were before." But he says, "Oh, we were a sinful nation. We deserved what you've done, and we still are sinful." And so what is the Lord going to do? And the greater part of chapter 9 is made up of this great prayer. And then God sends the angel to Daniel to bring him an answer. And the angel gives an answer in four verses, which have been argued about perhaps as much as any four verses in the Bible. And there is much in these four verses that is not at all clear. And there are about six views that are held of them, were held very tenaciously by various individuals. And people become very emotional that their view is correct. But most of those who interpret these four verses, Daniel 9, 24 to 27, most who do so approach it with a definite idea in mind. And then they try to fit everything into that definite idea. Now, there are two definite ideas that are widely held as an approach to it. There are those who say, these verses must tell us exactly how many years it would be before Christ would come. Now, that would be a very strange thing. If 400 years in advance he told exactly when Christ would come, that would be a very strange thing. We do not find predictions like that elsewhere in the Scripture. And God could do that if he chose. But we have no right to assume that he did that, and no right to twist the statements around in order to force them into giving us an exact number of years from the time of Daniel to the time of when Christ would come. I would say we have no right to do that. There are others who say we must do it, or at least who do it without saying anything about it, just insist that it occurred. But I say we should not approach it with such a presupposition. We should look at it and try to see what is there. And then when we do, we should emphasize what is clear first, and then should try to fit in with what is clear what is less clear. That, I feel, is the only reasonable approach to it. Now I see that I have already discussed what I put here as number A, the situation, by discussing the prayer and Daniel's answer coming to him. This is the situation. Verse 24 tells about the purposes. Verse 24 says that 70 weeks are decreed upon, are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy. I ask you for today to look at these verses and to see exactly what you think they mean, and whether there is a definite order. Many commentaries will insist that the first three are paralleled by the last three. The first by the fourth, the second by the fifth, the third by the sixth. And I think that is entirely imaginary. So I was interested to see how many of you would suggest that sort of an arrangement. And there were one or two papers that were given me last Wednesday, which said that the first three are negative and the last three positive. And that is an important observation. You can say there are three that are rather negative. They speak of destroying sin. And then number four speaks of bringing in everlasting righteousness. So it might be divided into two threes on that basis. But to say that one corresponds to four and two to five and three to six, you find dogmatically stated in many commentaries, and I do not think that it is warranted. Oh, I should mention at this point that there is another approach that is taken, which does not contradict the first false approach I just mentioned, to say this must point to exactly to the time of Christ. This other factor, which may be in connection with it or may be separate from it, is the assumption that this passage must look to the first coming of Christ and to nothing else. Now, there are a number of books written in recent years which take that assumption, which assume it can point to nothing else. It must only point to the coming of Christ. Now, when we notice that in the other chapters, they all look, except chapter 8, the other three all look specifically to the time of the complete destruction of human government. And we have not found in the book of Daniel any other clear prediction, any clear prediction anywhere else than in these four verses, of the first coming of Christ. Therefore, to assume that these verses must point only to the first coming of Christ is quite unwarranted. I believe they do point to the first coming of Christ, but to assume that that's all they point to is quite unwarranted. And there are many who interpret the statement in verse 27, which says he will put an end to sacrifice and offering, or he will cause sacrifice and oblation to cease, interpret that as meaning that Christ, by his death on the cross, put an end to sacrifice and offering. And it seems to me that is taking an assumption and reading it into the text, because we have the statements in two other places in Daniel, how little horn is going to cause sacrifice and offering to cease, referring to his putting an end to it. To say that in this case it means that Christ, by his death at Calvary, will cause sacrifice and offering to cease is quite out of parallel with what you find elsewhere in the book of Daniel. These other chapters point very definitely to the second coming of Christ. It would be strange if there was nothing in this chapter, in this particular prediction, that pointed to that. That doesn't prove it does. But to assume it points only to the first coming is utterly unwarranted. Now, as you looked at these purposes, some of them have been interpreted in many different ways. And I believe that to approach the passage, we should emphasize what is clear and then fit in what is less clear. And consequently, I believe that we should place considerable emphasis on the third purpose, which in the NIV is to atone for wickedness. In the King James Version, it says to make reconciliation for iniquity. But this word is used about 70 times in the Old Testament to mean atone. And there are only four cases where it is translated make reconciliation in the King James Version. I don't know why they did it in this passage. Because there is no passage I know of where it means to reconcile in today's sense. Now, perhaps in the time of King James, the meaning would fit. But today, if I reconcile you, it simply means I make each of you stop thinking false things about the other and become friends again. And that's not what this term means. This term means when one is at fault, to provide some way of remedying the fault so that they can again be friends. In other words, atonement. It is used constantly in the Old Testament in connection with the sacrificial system, the making of atonement. This is the standard word for atonement. And so I don't know why the King James Version in this particular case translated to make it to make reconciliation. But it the word definitely means atonement, and in the few cases where it is not used in connection with the sacrificial system, it is used of somebody making somebody else friends with him again by repaying him for something or making up for something that he's done to hurt him. So that it is an exact parallel in the few cases where it's used of relations with people to what it means of our relationship with God. So this third one, it seems to me, is we can say is definite proof that this passage, the only one in the book of Daniel, does look to the first coming of Christ. I think we can say that positively from that third purpose. And then when you look at the first, second, and fourth, they are read in the King James to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to bring in everlasting righteousness. Now there have been various interpretations of those. I know of one very fine Christian writer who insists that they all describe what Jesus Christ did at his first coming. Makes one of them, I think he makes put an end to wickedness described as going into the temple and driving out the money changers, for instance. Which it seems to me is a rather small thing to make in view of these great purposes here described. But there are a number of writers now who insist that it must all refer to the first coming of Christ. But these three purposes, to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to bring in everlasting righteousness, it seems to me must refer to that which is so stressed elsewhere in Daniel, to the complete end of the reign of wickedness over the world, with the complete destruction of the statue and the complete destruction of the fourth beast. So I think we can say that we can reasonably expect to find references, clear references, to both the first advent and the second advent in this passage. I see I got ahead of my outline there. I mentioned that second advent, some or all of first, second, and fourth purposes. Now we have the sabbatical year, we have the seven sevens, followed by the jubilee. I feel it is utterly wrong to say they can't be precise periods. But we have no right dogmatically to assume they are precise periods. It is also possible to approach it with the question, are they exact numbers of years or are they general periods of time? And some very good interpreters have taken this latter view. Number two is the anointed one in verse 25, Christ or Cyrus. I believe that is important. Isaiah 44, 26 to 45, 1 says, Cyrus will rebuild Jerusalem. He will rebuild my city. He is my anointed. This very term, Messiah, anointed, is used of Cyrus. We have no right to assume that this word Messiah in verse 25 means Christ. I believe it does in verse 26. But in verse 25, we have no right to assume it in either case without examination, and certainly no right to assume that in 25.